Good evening. Welcome to the Solari Report. Today is Thursday, April 19th, 2012. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. I'm in Palo Alto, California tonight, and we had a great lunch with subscribers, a brunch in San Jose last Saturday. Australian subscriber Tony Brickstock and his wife Jackie, who's a wonderful, amazing head of the music ministry at the Jubilee Christian Center here in San Jose. Tony's a former PGA Tour golfer and happens to be an incredible chef. And we had about 20-plus subscribers, lots of engineers and technologists and entrepreneurs from the Silicon Valley area. And we came together and just had an amazing time, lots of group conversations and one-on-one conversations. We sent out Darlene sent out the email list to everyone who attended it, who had approved to share their email, so I'm hoping good friendships and conspiracies are already percolating. I'm leaving for Portugal tomorrow. One of my goals is to get a better understanding of what's really going on in the ground in Europe, so more on that when I get back. 2 weeks from now, we've emailed Western European subscribers to see if you'd like to join me for lunch in Lisbon this weekend, so you can RSVP on the blog. Our theme tonight is a hot time in Latin America. It would almost have been a perfect week to talk with John Rappaport about the and Ellis Medavoy about how to do distraction. We had all of the leadership in the Americas meeting at the Summit of the Americas in April 14th and 15th, and that's a pretty big meeting. We had the U.S. president down there. We had Canada there, literally all of the Americas. It's the sixth summit. And there were some pretty serious issues. Probably the most serious was the increased trade competition within the Americas and more sort of barriers going up as currency wars occur, more trade tariffs and real economic troubles. How are we going to handle the kind of competition and the way it's turning? That was one on the issue. You're seeing more and more people in Latin America and more leaders looking for liberalization of the drug laws. The war on drug is very expensive, very destructive, and, of course, works to the United States' benefit. And so the United States, of course, don't want to talk about legalization. Those two things were completely papered over by the fact that we had what I would call a phony baloney scandal about members of the U.S. military and Secret Service and the advance team seeing prostitutes. And it was amazing this week. I'm in California. I was driving around and using someone else's car that was turned, everything was turned to NPR. And I can't tell you how much of the news was filled with the prostitution scandal. I was amazed. It was very hard to get real information on the real issues. But it's not surprising, given the, particularly in election year, the desire of the American leadership to not, and the Canadian leadership to not want to talk about the real issues, particularly why they want to keep the war on drugs going. We had a new blog post that I put up on the blog that's connected to that on the extraordinary explosion of the prison population in the United States. It's going to become a bigger and bigger issue, and I'll talk about it another week. But we're literally so significantly outpacing the rest of the world in terms of the per capita prison population that it's an embarrassment, particularly given the extent to which that prison population is being swung over to provide a literally extremely low cost, if not slave labor, for large corporations and the government. So we'll talk about it another time, but it's part of the drug liberalization, drug law liberalization conversation, and it's very serious. Money and markets, the markets are trading sideways, sort of in a channel. This has the potential to go on for some time, particularly coming into the summer, which is a low point for both usually commodities and the stock market. We see the new head of the IMF, Christine Lagarde, in the United States and in Europe, cheerleading and raising money for a new IMF bailout fund, calling the financial system fragile. Obviously, that's true, and it's why I and many other people in the markets expect more QE, quantitative easing from the Fed. We saw, to give you a sense that the cash flows are getting meaner and tighter and meaner and tighter, we see the Vatican scold a Catholic nuns group for deviating from Vatican doctrine. It was quite surprising and shocking to many people in that community. Usually there's been a long history in the Americas of the Vatican coming down on the nuns, and it's usually, I would say, an offense and or offensive tactic, and a lot of it has to do with controlling what are not insignificant resources and assets that the nuns have created or built up. So that's another sign to me that says this election year could get very dirty and things could get quite uncomfortable after the election. So the Vatican, a very aggressive move on the Vatican, a very political move, and one worth watching. Listening to the sort of NPR this week, I heard more slick propaganda on the election, on the national election, than I've heard in a long time. Now, I just happen to be listening to NPR, so I don't want to pick on them. I could have been listening to anyone on the political spectrum, and I'm sure I would have heard the same sort of slick, dirty stuff, all basically telling you but that you have no choice but to come back into the duopoly, you know, the McDonald's versus Burger King duopoly, and vote for one or the other. So on some of them, you're going to hear you have no choice. You know, Romney is at least better than Obama, or you have no choice to not vote for Obama because at least he's better than Romney. And you absolutely do have a choice. Don't listen or buy any of it. Feel free to vote for a third party, for an independent. For the last couple of presidential elections, I've voted for Ron Paul. I think before Paul was running, I voted at one point Kelly O'Meara, wonderful Washington reporter, and I voted for her brother. We just wrote Kelly O'Meara's brother in because we liked him so much and thought he would make such a great president. But refusing to play along with a duopoly is absolutely a power, so feel free to exercise it. Even more important, the state and local elections, I'm just going to keep beating this drum. Wherever you are, particularly if you can turn out in the debates, discuss with your neighbors, give campaign contributions, you know, a small campaign contribution strategically made along with participation in a local election can make an enormous difference. So I would really, really encourage you to realize that there's a lot you can do in the elections, and you can be very powerful. But so don't buy the fact that you've got to, you know, that one part of the duopoly is you're cornered inside of one part of the duopoly because you just don't have to go back in. Our hero this week is Chris Powell, who was on last week. If you didn't get a chance to listen to the Precious Metals Market Report, I would really encourage you to go back and listen to it. I was inspired to talk about Chris as the hero. He is a journalist who has for many years run a lot of the workload at the Gold Antitrust Action Committee, and has done just an incredible job of putting forth the evidence about what's going on in the market. I was inspired to make Chris the hero tonight because I got a question from one of you saying, wishing you a great spring season and continued success. Would you comment on the Sprout Gold Trust and the Sprout Silver Trust? I never give it securities advice on the Solaria Report, so I'm not going to comment on the details of the two. These are two ETFs sponsored by Sprout, a company run by Eric Sprout in Canada. Generally, I'm not comfortable with Sprout as someone governing and managing assets, so I won't comment on these particular securities, but I would say I've had several dealings and run-in with Eric, and he's just not someone I would who passes my due diligence test. So I think there are other other options in that market which are very strong. And generally, I the one thing I would say is if you're going to look at ETFs, it's very important to look at two issues. One, is the gold and silver really there? Number one, and number two, where are they trading in terms of premium and discount to melt value? And that is very important. The we have a special Solaria report. It's called GLD and SLV Disclosure in the Precious Metals Puzzle Palace, and it looks at the two iShares, the two big silver and gold ETFs, and you'll get a good sense of what many of the different issues are in taking a look and underwriting an ETF. A second question tonight, hopefully the subject line directed this to you. In an attempt to understand how intelligent people could make so many mistakes, lose all their wealth and homes, I started researching. My network did the same. It led us back to Promise, MERS, and artificial intelligence software on a fully automated system designed to hurt the layman, rape, pillage, and plunder a nation and the whole world. We found much. Patent, trademark, service mark, shell course, complete underground shadow banking system, and virtual economy. We even found software based upon a video game actually running the economy. We started out trying to save our homes and farms. Then we wanted to save the nation. No one would listen to us. Congress told me to put it on two pages. I laughed, I cried, I prayed. I know you have been fighting for decades. Based upon your knowledge, where's the real weakness in the system? God, we need some help. So let me repeat this again, and let me talk about the real weakness in the system. Another world is possible, and this relates what I said to the, you know, you don't have to go back into the duopoly. There is a great deal done to assure people that things are hopeless and they have to go along with sort of quote-unquote the way things are. The reality is if you look at the people leading the current effort to centralize the system, whether it's in a particular government or whether it's in private investment forces outside the government, they lack the what I call the mandate of heaven and what the Chinese call the mandate of heaven. We talked about it when we did the Soleri report with Victor Meyer and talked about the Sun Tzu's book, The Art of War. It's a big planet. It takes a lot of trust and cooperation to run the planet. You can't just govern everything based on force and sort of invasion of privacy and invasive technology. But so I don't expect this centralization effort ultimately to win. And but it is so important that we have an alternative picture of the future. I got a wonderful message from subscribers after we did the Soleri report with Bill Tiller, and one that I've described to you before. A marvelous friend of mine and subscriber in Vancouver wrote a letter and said, Oh my word, I just listened to Adam Trombley's interview on entrainment technology, and now I understand how so many people get tricked. And then I listened to Bill Tiller talking about the power of us to create our own intention, and then I listened to Adam Trombley's interview and watched Thrive about energy technology, and I realized if you look at the technology that's being used to control, and you use this, look at the technology that could be used to make all sorts of healthcare and energy and other things available if it was unsuppressed and integrated. And then you look at Tiller on the power of our ability to create the kind of world we want with our intention and for intention to impact material reality. She realized, you know, another world really is possible. It is possible to thrive. We don't have to live this way. And I think that picture is powerful because it's what attracts people out of thinking that they have to go along with the duopoly. I said to Franklin last week when we did the Precious Metals Report, you know, and you've heard me say this before, I think one of the reasons our subscribers really enjoy listening to Franklin is he's someone who said, look, I just don't have to go along. I'm going to go off and teach myself how to farm, and, you know, and we're just going to find another way. I did the same thing. And you can too. So it's all of this is why, and sort of this weak point is why I wanted you to learn and hear about the Alice Medavoy interviews that John Rappaport had did, and we talked about in our big interview with his new product, The Matrix is Revealed, because another world is possible, and I think the weak spot is the minute that a critical mass of people understand another world is possible and they don't have to live inside the Matrix, I think that's when this thing really starts to shift. And the most powerful thing we can each do is how we spend our own time and how we shift our own resources. It's one of the things we talk a lot about. And so one thing I will tell you is if everyone just starts making sure that you are immune to being sort of drained by the system, whether it's mentally or financially or every other way, the more we become resistant, the less we feed the machine. So By protecting yourself, you do an enormous amount to hit the system where it's weak because it is so leveraged. So, you know, when I tell people, you think you have a little bit of money in the bank, but enough of us shifting it, it makes an enormous difference. And just, I think the weak spot is the minute we all understand we're powerful and the system is a lot less strong than it looks, despite all the technology. Because, again, force is not enough to hold together a governance system, particularly for an entire planet. The other thing I wanted to talk about in the Ask Catherine section is there's been enormous controversy around Thrive, and I wanted to read, we got a number of comments in, and I posted part of the controversy up on the blog this week. Remember, Thrive is now streaming for free. It's a 2-hour and 15-minute documentary. Streaming for free, they've translated it into 10 languages. Other areas, I think Portugal, India, have translated into 5 more languages and given them the copyright. So it's literally available up on the Internet in 15 languages. So this is really a global conversation. And if you haven't watched it, I would really encourage you to, you know, get a group of people together, sit down, get some whatever it is you like to nosh on and watch it. Even watch, you know, parts, stop, discuss, keep watching because it's again, 2 hours and 15 minutes. So let me just read the first comment. I'm a new subscriber. I've watched the Thrive movement with great interest and suspicion. Do not get me wrong. The point I wish to make, I believe it was an extremely well done and informative video. However, I've seen videos and other information online for free, and I found it curious that a member of the Gamble family would undertake such an endeavor and then find it necessary to charge a $5 fee for the service. On that point, if you look at how much it costs to make and produce and distribute something like Thrive, they absolutely, Foster Gamble absolutely needs to charge money. And in fact, the reason they dropped the fee is that they found with the pirated versions that the free video encouraged so many DVD buyings that it was purchases. It was probably more economic to let it go for free. But absolutely, even if you're a Gamble, you don't have enough money to do that without getting some kind of financial return back. It was a very expensive endeavor and has taken many, many years. So the subscriber continues, I've also listened to Chris Hedges' interview and found him to be extremely intelligent and articulate spokesperson for much of what I too agree with. However, I would be willing to bet if either were asked what really happened on 9/11, they would not be so outspoken. In other words, they're both committing sins of omission and telling half-truths, which we know are much more dangerous than lies. I agree. The most dangerous lie you can tell is a material omission, and I'm very glad that this subscriber pointed it out. I will say, however, that if you're someone like Chris Hedges or Foster Gamble, and you're doing an enormous amount to illuminate things that are hidden or are very sensitive, you can't do everything. So, you know, if you look at Thrive, there are enormous number of issues that Foster takes on, including what I think are the most important ones, which is to ask the question, who's really running this, and are they running it according to criteria that are out of alignment with what's in our best interest? And I think he does an excellent job of that. But there are a whole world of issues that we've gone into in detail on the Soleri report because we've had hour after hour after hour for many years, and you just literally can't handle them all, particularly because to handle them at that level, you have to be an expert. So, or you need to just pour more money in documentation, et cetera. So if you look at you know, there's plenty on 9/11 and chemtrails and other things on their website, but they don't go into it in any kind of detail. So I'm happy to see somebody do what they can, but not be responsible to try and illuminate every issue in the world, because literally there's not enough time and money if you're one guy to do that, even if you have the money of a Gamble. So so there's a fine line between doing what you can and not being guilty of a material omission. So on 9/11, I don't pretend to be an expert on 9/11, but I always say, you know, I think the official story is a conspiracy theory, and it's clearly not, it doesn't hold up against the facts that we know. So the subscriber continues, you see, I've realized over the past 8 years that what is going on here on planet Earth is nothing new. It has been going on since man crushed grapes, since the first prostitute did her first trick or the first secret agent was hired. And she goes on, and then the question is, should I be suspicious of Mr. Gamble and Mr. Hedges? And I think that the question, I have worked with Foster Gamble for a long time. I don't know Chris Hedges, but I like him. I think these are sincere people, and they're doing their best. It's very, very important that we have a model of information where we listen, we take away from something what is useful to us, and then our response to that is rather than try and tear down the person who offered up what their best effort was, what we should do, you know, and so not be a crab in a bucket, but instead offer up what we think are additions or supplements or our own map or solution. So, for example, if Foster Gamble says, look, here's my map, here's my definition of the problem, here's what I think the solutions are, it's our responsibility to say, you know, terrific, I really appreciate your making that effort. Here's where I think your map can be improved. Here's where I agree with it. Here's where I disagree with you on solutions. Here's what I think the solutions are. And it's in that conversation that something emerges. We saw a group of progressives, led sort of by John Robbins and probably Paul Hawken, criticize Thrive pretty aggressively. And their contention seemed they didn't want to be associated with certain things the film was saying, or they had a problem with different people in the film, not so much what they were saying in the film, but what they were saying off camera. I must tell you that I think that the letter criticizing Thrive is the best example I can give you of why I sometimes say that I find the progressive community to be more damaging than just about any of the forces in America. And it's because we need to have a conversation, as this subscriber asked, we need to have a conversation without material emissions. Now, to have a conversation in material emission without material emission requires an awful lot of phenomena. And an awful lot of expertise. So Thrive has tried to do one that's very integrated and complete. It's not perfect. It couldn't possibly be. But we do need a conversation without material emissions. And if you look at the group of people criticizing Thrive, I think that they are guilty of significant material emissions, particularly the material emission that takes them out of their area of expertise and says, okay, what's going on in my area, whether it's healthcare or food or entrepreneurship, is really a symptom of a governance problem, and we need to go upstairs and look at that cross-cutting governance problem, and not just stick as an expert within the system. So I think that's part of what's happening, but it's a healthy conversation, and I would encourage you to watch Thrive. But again, I think that real maps and real solutions are going to emerge from many contributions, and I think it was one that was made sincerely. But there are going to be many more before something emerges that we're all going to say, ah, there it is, it's perfect. So with that, let me turn to our guest this evening. Jim Norman has been on the Solari Report more than any other person as a guest than Franklin Sanders, who co-hosts the Precious Metals Market Report. And one of the reasons I find his work in the energy world to be one of the most important contributions I can introduce you to understand what's going on in the world, and particularly what's going on that really drives how the financial markets and the commodities markets are trading and how that relates to the currency wars and how that relates to geopolitics. Jim's a veteran business journal. He has written for Business Week. He was a senior editor at Forbes. He retired in 2007 and is currently a contributing writer for McGraw-Hill's Platt Oilgram News, where he was working before he retired. He's written a book, The Oil Card, which I absolutely insist is a must-read. I, along with numerous other people, are trying to persuade Jim to write sort of an update to The Oil Card, but it is a it's still a very timely book. I can't recommend it to you strongly enough. It's easy reading, and you'll finish it, and you'll say, "Ugh, why didn't I read that long ago? I have a much better understanding of my world." I said in the last several Soleri reports, I talked about this question of American Renaissance. Is it fact or fiction? And at the heart of that question is what's going on domestically, what's going on domestically in the oil and gas industry, and what's going on globally as it is driven and controlled by the U.S. And I, given how much is going on, I asked Jim if he would come back this week to join us on the Soleri Report. So, Jim, are you with us?
Yes, thanks for inviting me back again.
Well, tell us. Let's start, Jim, with something you and I were talking about this afternoon about the relationship in the price of natural gas and oil. So let's start there and look at what's been going on domestically and how that relates to what you call the oil card.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, one of the great economic anomalies of all time, we're witnessing it right now in the oil and gas markets, where oil, crude oil, is trading at, say it's $125 a barrel for Brent crude, but natural gas is trading at less than $2 a thousand cubic feet. Now, it only takes about 6,000 cubic feet of gas to equal the BTU, or the heating equivalent value of a barrel of oil. What that means is that oil is trading at more than 10 times the BTU value of natural gas. It's never been.
So on a BTU equivalent, natural gas this afternoon was $11.65. So it's the equivalent of oil being $11.65 per barrel.
Right. Right. In fact, oil's trading at $125 a barrel. So go figure. It's the markets are so completely out of whack. That's really why I said about to write this book, because even back in 2007 when I started working on it, the oil price was just completely out of whack with reality of fundamental actual physical supply and demand volumes. And so the point of the book was to look at how you could manipulate oil upwards or downwards for geopolitical purposes if you had some goal in mind. And as a paradigm for that, we looked at how the U.S. and its allies actually did successfully move the price of oil down in the 1980s and kept it down for like a decade, significantly out of whack, to bankrupt the Russians and take away their ability to earn hard currency.
Yeah, and it worked.
It was bloodless victory in the Cold War, and even the Russians later came along and analyzed it and said, you know what really screwed us? It was that damn oil price. That's what did it. So then the book goes back and kind of flips that idea on its head and says, well, if prices are running up now for no good reason, are we doing this in reverse to somebody else, i.e. the Chinese, who are big oil importers and pay for crude with an undervalued currency and have to ship it halfway around the world? So, and then looking at that as part of a much broader landscape of economic warfare possibilities that you would envision against a country like China, for instance, driving up iron ore prices or bauxite prices, both of which have gone through the ceiling, remaining extremely high. There's a whole bunch of ways, if you got deep enough pockets, like the U.S. and its allies do, where you can actually affect global markets in seemingly fungible commodities like oil, raw materials, all kinds of stuff. Keep them out of whack for a long time and drive up the other guy's costs to the point where he really doesn't make any money. That's the situation in China. That's the basic problem with Chinese industry. It doesn't make any money. When you deduct the subsidies they get and the subsidized energy costs that they have, and the amount of bad loans in their banks made to industry, you realize Chinese industry really hasn't made any money forever. It's not a game that can go on forever this way. Of course, there's a lot of games going on right now that can't go on forever.
But they've gone on for an awful long time.
Yeah, and it's not going to end soon. I think that this could go on for decades. That's what we saw with the Russians, with the Soviets, that was a game that was in play for decades, really, before it finally had an effect. But then, you know, things just come to a tipping point at one point where something cracks, and boom, it's gone almost overnight. And that's...
Well, you know, if you look at what happened in Russia, you basically bring down the Soviet Union. And if you look at what's called the Rape of Russia, where we went in to do the privatizations afterwards, you basically have U.S. and European interests getting ownership and control of a huge amount of their oil industry.
Right, right.
So you bust them, and then you literally, you know, buy them cheap.
Right. We picked up the pieces, and it was done mainly through Russian fronts. And you could argue, I think, that Yukos may have been an example of that. Which we had close ties to the Rothschilds and so forth. Yukos is an interesting case study because, ExxonMobil this week announced a big deal to invest $500 billion in Russia through Rosneft, which is kind of the state oil major there, which ended up with most of Yukos' assets. To me, it was always interesting that the United States stood back and let Yukos be ripped apart by the Kremlin in 2003 and 2004. But actually, it would have been a key part of the whole effort to get the oil price up, because Yukos was ramping up its production. It was going to put a lot more oil on the market. It wanted to sell it directly into China by its own pipeline, and so I think that they had to be taken off the boards, because in 2003, people forget this, the Russians and the Saudis got together, had a series of meetings, and actually signed a secret, or they announced that they signed it, but they didn't say the contents of an accord to stabilize the oil markets, they called it. In fact, what they did was to allocate the world oil markets, and ever since then, Russian oil exports have bumped along at exactly half the level of Saudi oil exports. Saudis sell about 10 million a day. The Russians sell about 5 million a day, barrels a day abroad. Both could be doing a lot more. The Saudis could probably be 13 to 15 million barrels a day. The Russians could be double what they're producing if they really wanted to. Maybe not overnight, but they've got certainly the capacity to do it. In order to keep oil prices high, you've got to restrict the supply. And, and this kind of brings us back to this natural gas oil thing. Basically, what we kind of lay out in the book is how you basically, if you want to run oil prices up, you just encourage the cartelistas to do their thing, tighten the market, just snug it up enough so there's not a lot of crude sloshing around, and then you throw money at the paper markets, at the NYMEX, at the ICE, at the over-the-counter markets, the paper barrel market, which is just a financial world. And that's really where the price is set and where there's been a phenomenal, unbelievable influx of long demand buying paper barrels. The mystery is where all that demand has come from, and that's what we kind of look at in the book, as to how, if you are a nation state like the United States with its allies, you can actually marshal large volumes of funds to go in and salt the market to get this snowball rolling. Once you do, it tends to attract in vast amounts of other managed money, pension funds, everybody's piled into the market. And what the government has done through the CFTC rules and other trading and securities regulations, they basically opened the floodgates and removed all restrictions for hot money, managed money, other kind of non-industry players to come into the commodities markets and just blow these prices sky high. The government could put the kibosh on this in a heartbeat if they wanted to just impose the kind of limits that used to be in place for people who are trading these commodities. Instead, we've basically facilitated this runaway price phenomenon on the upside in oil. The question is, that I wonder about is, are we doing exactly the opposite for gas? If you look at the pattern of futures trading in gas contracts, natural gas, not gasoline, you see that whereas all of the managed money buying on oil is on the long side, on the gas side, it's all short interest. It's predominantly short selling of paper gas contracts on the New York Mercantile Exchange and particularly
the
on
price
the
down.
Continental Exchange. Pardon?
Driving the price down. So we're at a price, we're lower than we've been in 10 years, which inflation has been going on is an enormous. You know, if I went to Shadow Stats and got the real inflation numbers, it's an enormous drop in the real price.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, natural gas is just almost like a giveaway price. Not that your home heating bill goes down, because by the time they run it for all the pipes and the city gate and the Con Ed meter, you know, it still feels just as bad as before. But for the guy producing gas at the wellhead, it's quite punitive. And particularly for an industrial user of gas, this is nirvana. In the United States, you know, energy costs are one way or another, energy costs end up being, I think, about 40 or 50% of the cost of manufacturing in the United States. It's huge. It's the single biggest component. Labor is maybe 5 or 10% of the total all-in cost on most manufacturing, particularly heavy industry businesses. It's energy. Energy is what does it. And natural gas is the energy source for most American industry, not to mention petrochemicals, for which it's a feedstock and a fuel. That's a big business. It's a huge business, and one in which the United States has always had a dominant position.
I had somebody down in Texas say to me yesterday, he said, you know, gas is $2 here, it's $7 in Europe, it's $15 in Asia. And what we're talking about for U.S. manufacturing is an incredible competitive advantage.
Yes, it is, which is, I think, that's the real reason why you're seeing manufacturing and heavy industry actually moving back into the United States from abroad. It's not because our labor rates are cheaper, although they're getting relatively lower, too, but it's the energy cost. That's the real driver, and transportation costs as well. That's another factor. Transportation fuels are very expensive, but one of the virtues the United States has is it has an internal, heavily developed road and rail system. So you can move stuff around inside this country much cheaper than you can make it abroad, ship it all the way over here. So the United States has got a lot of inherent things going for it, which I think fit into your American Renaissance thesis. I think it's quite true. The United States, I mean, you might not see double-digit growth, but things are not nearly as bad here as they are in a lot of other places in the world, which are struggling to, I mean, China has to grow at 10% or else they get a compounding unemployment and social unrest problem there. They can't do that. They've cut their growth figures down to 8%. They'll be lucky to do that. And most of that is basically fudging the numbers anyway with stuff that shouldn't be in there. So,
well, let's go back for a second to the oil card, because one of the things we know is that the U.S. has been the beneficiary of controlling the reserve currency globally. And that reserve currency is completely tied to our control globally of the oil markets and the need to transact the oil exchanges in dollars. So there's a relationship between a currency being the reserve currency and controlling the trade in oil. You know, if I look at the military budget, one of the things I'm focused on is, okay, what's the military budget that ensures we can continue to control that trade? So, you know, if you see the squabble with Iran, and it comes down to, can Iran use the SWIFT system, and can the boat sail through the straits? So,
well,
it comes down to some very concrete flows.
I know. As people, you know, talk about this, and there's a lot of hand-wringing about it. Bottom line is, there's no other currency that could that has any kind of a chance of replacing the dollar as the world's reserve currency. There's just not enough liquidity in anything else. There aren't enough other dollars in any other currency floating around to make it work. And from there, the same thing goes for oil pricing. It makes, I mean, you could set up onesie-twosie situations where you even barter deals where you could pay for oil with something besides dollars. But it would be such a marginal trade that it wouldn't even be worth considering. It would only be a desperate act. So basically, oil is going to remain priced in dollars. And, you know, we're going to keep pushing the dollar down, so the oil price is going to keep moving up, which we like. And again, because it puts pressure on the Chinese ultimately will have to raise the value of their currency to buy that oil. That closes their ability to export cheap goods to the rest of the world. So it's all tied into what you mentioned. There's this global currency war going on, and it ratcheted up another couple of notches this week. You know, a bunch more countries, Brazil, cutting their interest rates, trying to get their currency down so they can export more stuff. You know, everybody is a race to the bottom globally.
Right. And I think that's one of the reasons that you saw sort of all this distraction related to the summit in Latin America. Because if you had real coverage of what was going on, the tensions over the currency issues are very, and the export-import and the trade issues are really getting very tense.
Well, yeah, I think that, and the way it tends to manifest itself is, I think, in all these other kind of bizarre instances of unrest. Look at China right now. I mean, they're actually going through a tremendous power struggle there with the ouster of this guy in Chongqing, who was buddies with the head of the state security apparatus. There was rumblings of coup stuff going on. There was worries that the military might take sides in this thing. The murder story lurking in the background there is,
You know, it's really funny because China has always done a great job of keeping the really perverted stuff behind the scenes. And, you know, I can't imagine everybody in China just, you know, because it's reached soap opera proportions. They're not used to this kind of out front kind of scandal. Do you know what I mean?
Right. I know. Yeah,
it's often entertaining for the Chinese style.
Well, but it's very dangerous, though, no matter which side you're on, because, I mean, there's such a small elite of people who rule that country with an iron fist based on basically people's willingness to be subjugated. If people decide, I'm tired of these guys, I mean, all of the Chinese army together couldn't keep order there, and in fact, the army would probably be the first ones to defect, so the party, the Communist Party there has got to be extremely nervous, which is why they've shut down the internet. They won't allow tweeting or blogging about any of this stuff.
You know, people have made up, you know, nicknames and are discussing everything with nicknames. So there seems to be workarounds on Twitter. When I was in the Bush administration, I had one of the deputies said to me, "This is ridiculous," he said. "It's like people in a lifeboat, in a rubber lifeboat, going in at each other with razor blades." And I think, you know, getting back to what I said before about the weakness in the system, I think the danger is, because any centralized system becomes too fragile financially at some point. And I think the squabbling and the infighting is going to be very destructive. And that's one of their that's one of the weaknesses in the system, and you're going to see it everywhere.
Because
we're operating, when you centralize the commodities markets like this, it gets very political everywhere. Let's go back, Jim, because I want to give the listeners a sense of what's been happening domestically to build oil and gas reserves domestically and what the new fracking technology is doing to impact that. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the extent to which we've really done an enormous amount to build and grow reserves and accessible reserves in the last 10 years.
Yeah, yeah. Well, this is where the whole peak oil mantra really breaks down, because technology is just relentless. And it's not even so much rocket science. It's just a steady application of stuff that makes sense. And fracking is a good example of that, along with horizontally directed drilling. I mean, we've gotten very precise now. You could target a 3-foot layer of rock that runs for miles, and you can drill down and then curve and go into that and stay within that 3 feet for a mile or so. Then you would go in and crack the rock with fracking, fracture stimulation, and you could take out lots and lots of gas or oil from very deep in the ground. And you know, people get very upset about the environmental impacts. In fact, the environmental impacts from this are much, much less than drilling a bunch of vertical wells that you'd have to drill to get at the same rock. Because the problem, the pollution problems from this are not where you crack the rocks way, 10,000 feet down. That's not the problem. The problem where you get, the smell of sulfur in people's water taps and flames coming out of your water tap. A problem with that is hydrogen sulfide gas that gets into a local water table from a leaking well casing from the vertical well up near the surface, where the old casing rusts away. The gas gets into an aquifer maybe 20 or 100 feet below the surface. Then it moves around and causes problems. So you could obviate hundreds and thousands of vertical wells by doing more horizontal wells and then fracking them. And what they're doing with these fracks now, instead of doing massive explosions like underground to crack the rock, they're just doing many, many more small fractures. So I think fracking...
Part of the problem is with a lot more drilling activity. You know, Americans aren't used to this level of drilling activity, particularly in the areas which are busy. You know, this is all new to them because so much of the, you know, we've been sourcing abroad, not sourcing. We've let these reserves stay dormant, whether we, you know, it was too expensive to touch them or we just decided to use everybody else's up first. Mm-hmm. And I think the problem is in a local area when you can't trust the corporations. If something goes wrong, you can't trust the corporations or the government to handle it. You know, that's the problem. There's no regulatory structure that can be trusted to fix things in the instance where something goes wrong. And it's that breakdown of trust that's causing all sorts of problems. So.
Yeah, although I think we've got a pretty robust regulatory system in place in most of these areas where there's the drilling. You know, and I think you're always going to have industrial mishaps. You're moving around a lot of iron and stuff, so that stuff happens. But I think, by and large, the situation's pretty well under control. And if it's not, it's going to be regulated.
Right.
The bottom line is, we're creating a heck of a lot of wealth here in terms of reserves and production. I mean, U.S. oil production has been steadily rising. We're up to like 6 million barrels a day. We only import about 8 now. But we had been importing a lot more than that. So our imports are down. Our production's up. And
our gas reserves, my impression, have grown dramatically in the last 10 years.
Yeah, they're huge. I mean, the theoretical amount of gas recoverable underground is just off the charts now. I mean, literally, you got hundreds of years of it. Gas production is very, very robust. I mean, like the U.S. uses, if I get these numbers right, about 22 or 23 trillion cubic feet of gas a year. About half of that is commercial industrial. About a third of it is for electricity generation. The rest is domestic use. But we produce maybe 25 or 26 trillion cubic feet a year. Now, some of that just goes into to pressurize the pipeline and stuff like that. It gets used up. But like, we import from Canada maybe 3.5 trillion cubic feet a year. that's going to come down dramatically. And we're actually getting to the point where we're going to be exporting, I think, decent amounts of gas in the form of LNG, which will sell on the world market at a BTU equivalent price to oil. So, you know, we could turn this thing around.
Take it at $2, ship it to Asia, and sell it for $15.
Exactly. Right.
Right.
So I think that's got some definite potential. So what we'll do, we'll be backing gas back into Canada. The Canadians can use it to produce oil sands or whatever up there. So, yeah, I think we're gonna have plenty of gas. The big problem will be that our storage capacity now is probably going to fill up in September, like 10 weeks before the withdrawal season begins. So you're going to have this period this fall where prices could get really low, where they're producing gas and there's just no place to put it, and the winter demand hasn't kicked in yet. So,
in fact, one of the, and this relates to the gas that you put in a car, not the natural gas. One of the questions is Stansberry Resource Report is warning that oil prices are set to crash by summer. Do you believe there will be a dramatically lower price in gas, that's car gas, soon?
No. I think, and this is my contrarian thesis in a book, that oil prices are going to stay high regardless of anything. They're completely unhitched from physical supply and demand. We want them high, and they'll stay high. Net gasoline prices hovering around $4 a gallon, you know, that's bad. It's a nuisance. Nobody likes paying it. But, you know, for the United States as a whole, what we pay for gasoline is a bargain compared to just about anywhere else in the world. And it's not going to – I don't think it's a gasoline price that keeps people from driving so much. I think it's the fact that they don't have a job to go to anymore, and they just don't need to do a lot of routine driving and don't have the time to sit in traffic jams. Plus, the cost of the cars are so high now that, you know,
right. Well, I think it's the overall cost. But where I live, you know, the gas is pinching people. There's no doubt about it. They really, you know, there are a lot of things they don't do now, and it's because the cost of the gas and the cost of maintaining the car, you know, is greater.
Right.
Well, you know, tomorrow is the second anniversary of what happened in the Gulf, and you've been wonderful about coming on the Salieri Report and talking about what's been happening in the Gulf. I thought maybe you could give us quickly an update on what do you think is happening there and what it means to the oil card.
Yeah, well, from the oil card perspective here, in terms of oil markets and oil prices and stuff, I think the government has taken its goodly time in getting things back to normal in the Gulf. I mean, it's been 2 years since that happened. And, you know, when it happened, they had an immediate moratorium on drilling in the Gulf for like 4.5 months. Then they had this, they called it a permitorium, where basically you couldn't get any permits approved anyway. So, I mean, we had been permitting, forget the number. It was like 160 wells a year in the Gulf of Mexico. Now we're getting permits for maybe 80 or 90. So it's still only running like half the rate, although there's more rigs back, and I guess they'll be drilling eventually, but I think at a much slower pace. Oil production from the Gulf had been about 1.5 million barrels a day before Macondo. It fell down to like 1.1 million. It's kind of creeped up. It's like 1.3 million now. It's still running below what it was. So, and that's like a quarter of the oil produced in the United States comes from the Gulf of Mexico.
Right.
So, you know, the government has basically left that oil in the ground. The opportunity cost has been huge, an amount of oil that has just not been produced there, but the government seems to be in no rush to do that. In the meantime, you have increased oil production from a whole bunch of other venues. You know, the Williston Basin and the Dakotas. You got South Texas, various other places where mainly the independents, not the big guys so much, but the independent companies they've been out there drilling like mad to get at these tight reserves. And so that production has been going up. Production in North Dakota doubled. It's like 600,000 barrels a day, doubled in the last 3 or 4 years.
So there's tremendous activity. I told you I came through Texas in March. Oh, my God. It's just booming. Tremendous, tremendous activity in the oil patch. So you really feel the activity in terms of sort of just domestic, the growth of the industry domestically in terms of activity and people.
Although what's interesting is that, it's not the big guys. It's not the major oil companies that are increasing this oil production. It's the little guys. It's the independents. And that's exactly what you would expect from a cartelized effort to keep the oil price up. I mean, truth to tell, it's the big guys who spend the vast bulk of capital money in the oil patch. And they're sitting on their hands, really. It's the little guys who are out there begging, borrowing money to go drill wells now. But the big guys...
125, oh my.
Yeah.
Well, also, I wanted to ask you about the Keystone Pipeline has become quite a political football in Washington, with the sponsors trying to get it approved and the president not approving it, especially during an election year.
Right.
Maybe if you could just comment a little bit about what the Keystone Pipeline is and why it's so controversial.
Right. Well, it was a large volume pipeline that would bring oil from the Canadian oil sands ventures all the way down to the Gulf Coast where it could feed into U.S. refineries. Now, there are other pipelines that can kind of get you down there, but it's a circuitous route. It's basically old gas pipelines that they reverse. I mean, this would have been like a superhighway that would have brought big volumes of that crude down to the Gulf Coast. And the effect would have been to trash the oil price, the crude price on the Gulf Coast. And that was just not copacetic with the overall geopolitical theme. They want to keep the oil price high. If you had all of that Keystone oil coming down to the Gulf, you'd be knocking down the crude price by 10, 20 bucks a barrel, I think, potentially. And that was, you just don't want to do that. So this is the main problem you have to keep oil prices high. You got to keep a lot of oil in the ground or backed up. So I think we just as soon keep that oil up in Canada for a good while longer. Or I mean, we've already taken significant amounts. It comes into the Midwest. I don't think we want to let it get into the Gulf Coast. If the Canadians want to try and build a pipeline over the Rockies to the West Coast and sell it to the Chinese, well, be my guest. I mean, it'll cost them a fortune. The Chinese will pay through the nose for that oil. So, the volumes would not be that tremendous anyway. But the key thing, if you want to maintain the global price structure, you just don't want to dump a lot of crude oil on the Gulf Coast like that.
Right. Well, it seems to me that what we're saying is there's certainly a profound change going on, both in terms of the relationship between the oil and gas prices and the activity in terms of building domestic reserves. And I think, to me, if you're sitting back and looking at the particularly what's happening with currencies and the sort of state of the U.S. participation in trying to dominate the global economy, I think there is a real question as to whether or not the U.S. will be able to pull another rabbit out of the hat to keep its position strong. And so to me, the oil card and the way they're managing it says, they can. They have the combination of control of natural reserves, management of the commodities and financial markets, and military presence to play the oil card. So I say, they can play the oil card, and it's going to make a dramatic difference to what the U.S. position is going to be globally over the next 10 years. What do you say?
Well, I think that's exactly right. And again, it's like a poker game where you don't need to have all the money in the world. You just need to have deeper pockets than the guy sitting next to you. And we do.
Right.
And we know how to play this game so well, I think, that they can't resist doing it. You know, it's their natural instinct now is to basically wage war through economic markets. And they're very good at it. I think they've figured out how to basically direct funds and to channel investment flows in ways that accomplish these purposes.
On one hand, I agree with you that they're very good at it. On the other hand, I think it's become such an unattractive system and culture that, you know, it's a real, you know, yes, they can control the commodities markets, but no, I really don't want to have dinner with a tapeworm.
Right. You know well, I mean? I agree. And, I mean, they're really in uncharted waters here. Well, you're talking about zero
right.
interest rates for years and years and years and oil prices that are completely off the charts. I mean, who knows the unintended consequences that we're buying for ourselves, not to mention the huge amount of debt that stands behind all of this. So it's hard to even conceive of what the end game is going to be from all this.
Right. But, and part of the problem is if you look at the debt and the financial system, you basically have a naked short in all the different, you have a naked short in the government market, you have a naked short in the commodities market, you have a naked short in the mortgage market that is, you know, that is of a size which is sort of mentally and emotionally overwhelming for most people to even admit. So, you know, there's a weakness in the system, and that's why I think they have to be as ruthless as they're being in managing it. You
that's
know, it's
well
quite
put.
Phenomenal that anything works at this point.
Yeah. I know,
how do you govern without it?
It not work. You can't let it not work at this point.
Right.
So everybody just carries on.
Right. Well, Jim, I have to tell you that it's always a mind-boggling experience to talk to you, and I can't thank you enough. I'm going to pressure you now. You have to write an update to your book. You just have to.
Okay. No, thank you. You have been one of my great supporters, and you're just so patient, and it's so refreshing to talk to somebody who at least gives me the time of day, because this kind of thinking is so. Contrarian, people are just not accustomed to even thinking in these terms, but it explains a lot.
Well, if you've ever taken the time to sit down and unpack the mortgage market the way I did, then suddenly you realize that what you're saying, not only can it be true, but of course it has to be true. I mean, it just has to be true. So once
yeah.
you know, whether you unpack the suppression and the management of the gold price, or you know, I came to it through mortgages. Then suddenly you start looking around and saying, well, it can't just be, you know, one database can't just be in this operating system. If this database is in this operating system, they all have to be in this operating system. And then you look at it very, very differently. And I think what we're trying to integrate is, you know, some of us came up through mortgages, some of us came up through precious metals, you came up through oil and energy, and we're trying to put it together and say, you know, and build an integrated map. Because my point of view is I just want to make sure that the families and subscribers that I'm responsible for and people who will read my blog, I can help them not get, you know, if the train's going to come down these tracks, I want them to be able to jump off before it hits them. So, you know, we need to be able to see what's going on so that we can navigate our world or navigate our assets through this world. And that means building an integrated map of all these different things. But I think your point is very well taken, that the naked short is so bad, they have to win. They have to win. And that's what
yeah.
I think it's very important for everyone to understand, because, you know, I see so many commentators say, oh, well, I don't like this or I don't like that. Well, wait a minute. If you were in their shoes, what would you do? Would you have any other option but to do what they're doing? And that's
right.
That's the thing that I think your work just does an incredible job of helping us understand. So, now tell us your website again.
Let's see. It's called theoilcard, all one word, .com. If you go there, you can read a little bit about the book and about me and some glowing recommendations from some very good oil analysts. And you can pick it up on Amazon, or you could... I think get it from a publisher there on a website. It's a little outfit called Trine Day. Very gutsy guy, Chris Milligan, out there in Oregon.
Great publisher. Great publisher.
He's got some astounding books out there. I don't know how he's managed to stay alive, let alone in business, but I got to hand it to him. They have an 800 number to it. 1-800-556-2012, if you can believe it.
Okay, well, we're going to keep up with you, and we're in cahoots, and so don't be surprised when I want you back on the Solaria Report in short order, because it's going to be, you know, the oil card is going to play out this year through all the international tensions and what's going on in the Middle East, not to mention this, what I think will be a very fractious, dirty election. So there's a lot to talk about, and it's going to be ongoing. So, Jim, have a great night.
Thank you. It was a pleasure. Good evening.
Okay, let's go to the movies. I wanted to make a short comment on The Hunger Game, and in fact, we had somebody post a question. Let me read it to you. I'm gravely concerned about the popularity of Hunger Games. Conditioning of people to kill one of your own brings back memories of Rwanda in spring 1994. Seven people killed per minute for just over 100 days. Conditioning young people to get used to the idea of killing their own is never a good idea and will not serve this culture well. The Hunger Games is a phenomena. The movie's came out in the third week of March, first in France and then in the United States. It's based on a book and trilogy of the same name, The Hunger Games, by Suzanne Collins, who was part of producing the movie, and it's targeted at young adults. It's about a post-apocalyptic world and where the sort of economy and the places have been divided into districts, which have no self-sufficiency. Each one is focused on a particular part of the economy, and all the districts are controlled by a highly advanced metropolis that lives high on the hog, sort of the capital high on the hog, as people in the 12 districts suffer. They had tried to revolt and failed, and now to honor that process of revolt and to remind everybody not to do it again, they have something called the Hunger Games, where every district sends a young man and woman and who are put in a natural setting, but that's really a very highly technologically controlled arena. And they're basically, you know, it's like a big reality TV show, not unlike some of the ones we've been watching over the last 15 years. And basically all 24 young people are supposed to go into the arena, and only one is to emerge, the one who succeeds in killing all the others, and it's called The Hunger Game. And I won't go into the details of exactly what happens, because if you're going to see it, I don't want to spoil it for you. I did watch it. I would say it's not a great movie, but it does have the feeling that I get from a lot of young people today, the feeling of coming up in a world where your opportunities have been restricted or limited. There's far more invasive control and a feeling of really having the adults be predatory and exploitive towards young people. If you look at every county in America, the greatest investment we make in every county is educating and bringing up our young people. But in many counties in America, you're either headed for the army, for jail, or off to Harvard, you know, the capital, where you proceed to help the capital exploit the districts. There's not really a lot of opportunity for most young people on Main Street to really go into small business, build up equity. It's one of the reasons I spent so much time in the 90s working on venture funds, to try and really bring a way for young people to build up wealth within a place. If you look at Franklin Sanders' operation, one of the reasons it's so successful is he has six kids and their kids, and you have an enormous amount of very talented young entrepreneurs coming up in the businesses, whether it's the farm or the precious metals dealership, and that makes an enormous difference. So part of, I think, my interest in watching The Hunger Games is it gives you a vision of a world where we don't do that, where we don't create a new picture for ourselves and then start to shift our equity into a world that really creates opportunities for young people to build wealth on Main Street and stay and build up the, quote-unquote, the 12th district. So the popularity of the Hunger Games does concern me. It's an ugly vision of a world that's very, very competitive, and I think it resonates with a fear that a lot of young people rightly have, because if you look at student loans, if you look at globalization, if you look at the way they've been positioned, they are not part of a society which is really organizing to help them succeed in what is going to be a very, very different world. So it's not surprising. And I think my takeaway comes back to what the subscriber asked before about where is the weakness in the system. The weakness in the system is that it can't show young people a really attractive picture. And if we can show people a very attractive, young people a very attractive picture, I think that shifts where the future can go. So ladies and gentlemen, that's it for tonight. On May 3rd, I'll be back talking about what I found in Portugal and Europe. We're going to do something that many subscribers have requested, which is an overview of the Solari Report resources. You become a new subscriber, or you've been around for a while, but you really haven't accessed it. I want to walk up and down your balance sheet and income statement and say, okay, what are the resources and how can they help you? How can they enrich your life and the life of your family? So I'm gonna walk you through the Solari Report resources and tell you what's there and how to access it. And then May 10th, of course, we're back with Precious Metals Markets Report. I'll be over in at the top of the World Farm with Franklin Sanders. So again, luncheon coming up in Lisbon this weekend. So if you're in Western Europe and you want to come join us, let us know. You can sign up through the blog after you log in. And until May 3rd, please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in a conspiracy, then you need to start one. Ladies and gentlemen, good night and good luck.